This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
And today in our 433rd episode, we have some news about dinosaur diversity and how it was doing around the end of the Cretaceous.
And also the Jurassic.
Nice. We also have an interview with John Holmes, who recently recreated a Tolkien presentation from the early 20th century about dinosaurs, which is super cool. And unfortunately, we couldn't make it to it because it was at Oxford. But since we have this podcast, I convinced him to come on the show and sort of recreate some of it for us, which is just such a perk. And I hope you all enjoy it too. We also have Dinosaur of the Day, Atlasaurus, and of course, a fun fact. But before we get into all of that, as always, we'd like to thank some of our patrons who are the driving force keeping our podcast running. And this week, we have one new patron to thank, and that is Robbo2. Thank you very much for joining. And rounding out our shout-outs, we've got Bradley, Arlosaurus, Robert, Wouter, Trev, George, RC, Paulacanthus, and Stephanie.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being part of our community. We really appreciate you. And all our patrons.
Jumping into the news, we've got the latest update on why non-avian dinosaurs went extinct after the Cretaceous-ending asteroid, also known as the KPG boundary.
One of the biggest questions around dinosaurs.
It is a popular one, which we basically considered settled, that it was an asteroid or a meteor. We don't know for sure what kind of extraterrestrial body it was that slammed into Mexico, but whatever it was, that's what wiped out the dinosaurs. But there have been recently papers pointing out that, relatively speaking, dinosaurs may not have been doing as well at the end of the Cretaceous as they were at other points in their history. And maybe they were sort of primed for extinction at that point. This latest paper was by Jorge Garcia Giron and others and published in Science Advances. And they point out that, relatively speaking, mammals didn't do that well through the extinction event.
Did anyone do well through that extinction?
Well, they did, but they said mammals and squamates, also known as lizards and snakes, quote, suffered considerable losses. Mm-hmm. And that's not just saying individual animals, but also species went extinct. But meanwhile, crocodilians, turtles, and freshwater salamanders, quote, survived nearly unscathed.
Interesting.
I think we've heard about crocodiles before. Like crocodilians were in some of the best position, but I didn't remember hearing about turtles and freshwater salamanders.
I should have guessed turtles because they come up in everything.
The two. It's interesting, too, that they're all semi-aquatic ectotherms and also basically all freshwater animals. And yeah, so maybe cold-blooded reptiles and lizards that spend a bunch of their time in freshwater were uniquely situated away from some of the worst effects of the fire and the earthquakes and all that kind of stuff. Previous studies have mostly looked at the speciation of dinosaurs. In other words, how fast new dinosaur species were evolving. The idea being that more new species evolving indicates a successful group. It's sort of expanding, filling new niches. It's around, it's mating a lot. So there's genetic material changing around, all that stuff that shows that a group of animals is doing really well. But these authors tried to take a new approach at it, and they wanted to look at how animals survived by looking at how the speciation of different groups are interrelated.
So a more macro view.
It's really complicated, and the math took me a while to wrap my head around. Mm. But basically, they're trying to connect how the diversity of each group of animals impacts the diversity of other groups of animals in their environment and actually between environments.
Hmm.
So
it does sound complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated. So Basically, they were trying to answer two questions. Were there any changes in the food web before the KPG boundary? And second, do those changes explain why non-avian dinosaurs went extinct? They focused on Western North America. It's a very popular spot to focus on.
There are a lot of dinosaurs to look at, a lot of animals in general to look at.
It has been pretty thoroughly excavated going back about 150 years. They compared three time periods. It's also a good spot because there are three time periods to compare. They have the Campanian, which is about 72 to 83 million years ago. That's sort of two steps before the asteroid impact. There's the Maastrichtian, which is about 66 to 72 million years ago. That's right before the asteroid. And then there's the Danian, which is 62 to 66 million years ago. And that's right after the asteroid. So they've got a while before, just before, and just after the asteroid impact. And they have basically all of Western North America. It's not just the Hell Creek. It's all of the formations around that the animals could have presumably interacted between. At the end of the Cretaceous, what they found is that the largest herbivores were declining, but medium-sized herbivores were diversifying and sort of having a larger impact on their environment. Now, I will say the math that backs this up doesn't have the most solid statistical numbers that I've ever seen in a paper, but I do like that they're trying a new approach for how to look at the data and how to see how these animals were interacting. But overall, you can say that the dinosaur speciation was basically stable and static.
So not going down.
No. Certainly, dinosaurs overall were still a large part of their ecosystems right up until the end of the Maastrichtian, right before the asteroid impact. But it might be the case that it was shifting. So they were going from the largest herbivores being maybe the most important to the medium-sized herbivores. And they did mention that there have been proposals that say in Africa, where there aren't elephants or other really large herbivores, it makes the environment a little less stable and more likely for things to get mixed up, you know, like smaller animals to rise and become more significant in their ecosystem. They also said that that stability of, you know, the dinosaurs being stable and static instead of essentially diversifying might mean that the dinosaur groups were basically stuck in their individual niches. And then when the asteroid hit, they weren't prepared to step out of those niches, sort of try new things.
They couldn't adapt.
Yeah. It also appears that in the latest Cretaceous, mammals and birds were becoming a more significant part of the environment.
So it was already happening.
Yes, exactly. The way the authors put it was, quote, mammals did not simply proliferate after the extinction event. Rather, their earlier ecological diversification might have helped them survive, end quote.
Oh, thanks, mammal ancestors.
Right? Although, again, you know, they didn't all make it through.
No, but the ones that led to us did, so yep. That's the important thing.
It is. So in terms of when the asteroid hit, dinosaurs might have been particularly vulnerable because they were sort of stuck in these niches, and mammals and birds might have been particularly unvulnerable, you know, prepared in a way for the asteroid impact, for this big turnover, because they were diversifying and there were some more generalists trying out different ecological spots. However, they do not go as far to say that dinosaurs were declining or that mammals would have replaced dinosaurs without the impact. More like at this snapshot in time, it looks like mammals were doing pretty well. They were diversifying and dinosaurs weren't.
That mammals were in a position that once this happened, they could take advantage, and there's a lot more nuances than just the asteroid hit. That was the end.
Yeah. And it wasn't the replacement hypothesis of like mammals were just waiting and waiting and waiting. And as soon as dinosaurs went extinct, whether that had happened 40 million years earlier, mammals were bound to replace them. It might be that it was just this moment in time. I would really like to see a comparison to other time periods, because we sort of know the result of this, right? We know that after the Maastrichtian, mammals took over. So we're sort of working backwards. I'd like to see if they took the same statistical analysis and did it in the middle of the Cretaceous or the middle of the Jurassic and tried to see like, well, how are mammals doing then? Because yeah, I'd just like to see a little more testing of this new model, because it seemed like there was some hand waving with the numbers to make it make sense and fit into the story that we know.
Or it's just another example of like, looking at things in a different way, and then future research can build on it.
Yeah.
Cool. And continuing with our dinosaur diversity, how did climate affect dinosaurs diversifying and multiplying? It turns out it did make a difference.
Makes sense.
We have talked about it a little bit before with climate barriers. This was a study published by Emma Dunn and others and published in Current Biology, so open access if anyone wants to check it out. And the team, the authors were looking to better understand the early evolution of dinosaurs and their biodiversity. So they used models and statistical analyses to compare where dinosaurs lived and their climate conditions. Now, we know in the late Triassic, before the mass extinction event, dinosaurs were more rare and they were restricted to certain geographical areas. And then they moved around and they became much more abundant, eventually taking over the world. Now, this could be because of opportunity when other animals went extinct. It could also be a response to changes in the climate. In the models, they found that late Triassic sauropodomorphs were more restricted and they didn't live in the hottest, low latitude areas. They lived in cooler climates that changed with the seasons, very seasonal type things.
That's kind of funny because low latitudes means by the equator. And I feel like when we're talking about the bigger sauropods, not sauropodomorphs, but the true sauropods later on, I think of them as only being by the equator, not being in high latitudes.
Yeah. And that is kind of what happened, which is interesting. Speaking of climate affecting things. So the sauropodomorphs, they seem to be absent in the lower paleo latitudes in North America and Northern Africa. And those areas at the time had, it was very arid and humid. They had these extremes and there were a lot of wildfires and droughts. So it's possible that these sauropodomorphs couldn't handle it because they needed more reliable food sources to grow large.
Yeah, that makes sense. Imagining a huge sauropodomorph. Well, they weren't that huge then.
No.
But something that needed to eat a ton of plants in a desert is tricky.
Yes. And if your food sources are either dying from drought or burned up in wildfires, that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, theropods lived in a more variety of climates. It's not completely clear why this was the case, but it could be because there were herbivorous pseudosuchians all over, so there was some food for them.
Yeah. There was something they could kill and eat.
Yeah.
They didn't have to rely on lots of plants.
Exactly. Now, in the early Jurassic, sauropodomorphs spread out to their preferred climates, and that could be because climates changed, so there were those lower climate barriers, which we've talked about on the show before. And the sauropodomorphs also became just much more abundant. Then there was this shift for sauropodomorphs from living in the cooler climates to living in the warmer climates. And that's when the sauropods emerged because, again, sauropods didn't really live in these cooler areas. They lived in the warmer areas. And at the same time, other dinosaurs, not sauropodomorphs, shifted to living in cooler climates that had seasons.
Hmm.
So they kind of switched.
Although there are a lot of dinosaurs that lived in both, too.
Yes. But it's just interesting when you put in these models and you see these changes happening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's unclear how much the warmer climates were related to sauropods growing so big so fast. But bone histology shows that sauropods had sustained growth year-round. They're constantly growing. And sauropodomorphs had more cyclical growth that were interrupted by the seasons.
The early sauropodomorphs?
Yes.
I guess when we're saying sauropodomorphs in this, we're talking about basal sauropodomorphs
before the sauropods. Yeah.
Because technically sauropods are a type of sauropodomorph.
Yeah.
But that's not what we're going for.
That's true. But yeah, this could be interesting for future studies. And other future research, according to the authors, includes looking into the, quote, apparent absence of ornithischians in the Triassic fossil record, end quote, which could be because of climate or the environment or could just be incorrect phylogeny.
Yeah, because like that other recent proposal that psilosaurs are in fact ornithischians, that they're not missing in the Triassic fossil record anymore.
They were there all along.
Yeah. Could be like sauropodomorphs where they just looked a little bit different in the Triassic, and then in the Jurassic, they got into the form that we're all used to.
Yeah.
I never knew before that the basal sauropodomorphs had cyclical growth. I knew that later sauropods grew pretty constantly, and you could see how that difference would require a different sort of food intake pattern.
Yeah.
But I would have thought that if they had cyclical growth, that would have made them more adaptable and maybe capable of surviving in the desert. Because it's like if their growth rate slows down and their metabolism slows down, you'd think maybe they could. But maybe...
Maybe there was no favorable seasons in the desert.
Yeah. Yeah. It could be, or they lasted too long. Like they can slow down for a little while, like a month or something. But if it's dry for 9 months out of the year, it's not good enough for them. It also shows with evolution how you never know how it's going to go because there's so much randomness in there. We don't know why sauropods ended up that way. It could have been climate. It could have had to do with predation. It could have had to do with new plants evolving, all sorts of different things. And then you end up with this different set of animals that have different requirements and then they want to live in different places.
Mm-hmm. And they grow to be much larger.
Yeah. And then we see the random little branches of sauropods that suddenly got much smaller, depending on their conditions too. In just a moment, we'll get on to our interview with John Holmes. But first, we're going to take a quick sponsor break. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app.
How many ways can you say dinosaur? There's dinosaur.
Dinosaurio.
Konglong.
Dinosauro.
Okay, it's not enough to be able to say one word in multiple languages, but it is a fun start. And it's the start of amazing adventures, which reminds me of when we got to travel to Italy. In addition to all of the delicious food, we had the chance to check out the Natural History Museum of the University of Pisa, which has some pretty cool dinosaurs on display, including a replica Carnotaurus, which is known for having arms shorter than T-Rex and horns on its head, and it's identical to the original found in Argentina. They also have a reconstruction of a Saltosaurus nesting plan, and Saltosaurus are those long-necked dinosaurs covered in armor, and a really special gallery that shows the evolution of whales.
Oh yeah, I love the whale evolution. Yeah, we rented a car to go to the museum, and it helped to know some Italian to navigate around Italy, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying Italian for a little bit now, and it's a wonderful language. One of the coolest things about it is it's the modern version of Latin. So with dinosaur names, a lot of times the words are already familiar.
Not just the names, but like parts of dinosaurs.
Very true.
So enter Rosetta Stone. Learning languages really opens up the possibilities for adventure. And Rosetta Stone has been the expert in language learning for 30 years. It's designed so you can learn languages in an intuitive way and you remember your skills long term. And it ensures that you can pronounce each word.
And the best part is if you join now at rosettastone.com/dino, there's a special offer just for our listeners. And you can get more than 50% off lifetime access to 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino, D-I-N-O.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And now onto our interview with John Holmes. But if you like Tolkien and you're a patron, I highly recommend listening to the extended version of this interview because it was fantastic. There's so much cool Tolkien stuff and different little side things we went down that weren't as dinosaur related. So we edited them out of this show, but they're in the extended version. So check that out in your premium content feed. We're joined this week by John Holmes, professor of Victorian literature and culture at the University of Birmingham. He is an expert on the Gothic revival and the Pre-Raphaelite movement. And we're speaking with him today because he recently recreated Tolkien's 1938 presentation on dragons. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very sorry that I missed the presentation. It looked amazing. And the pictures of it, it seems so cool.
It was enormous fun. It was absolutely great. We had a full house, which is quite rare for events at the museum. So there was a good buzz to the audience.
Awesome. Yeah, I saw not too long after one of the publications that this event was going to happen that there was no space, and then later that there was no waitlist space either. So yeah, it sounds like it was very well attended.
And that was in spite of the fact that we've had rail strikes in the UK. so one of the rail strikes ended up being timed for the day.
Oh no.
So they were literally counting people out as they were having to cancel because they couldn't get there by train and contacting the people on the wait list. And so I knew somebody who was there. One of my students was there with his girlfriend, and she was something like 59th on the wait list. And he was dependent on her being able to drive him there. And it finally got to her at, I don't know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon or something. So off they went and they came along.
Just trying to convince her, like, I know you didn't come up on the wait list, but could you just drive me there and wait in the car?
Exactly.
So was the event actually in the museum itself, or was it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
The event was, so we held it in the lecture theater where Tolkien gave the lecture. Oh, so the lecture was given on the 1st of January, 1938. It was part of a season of Christmas lectures. They have about half a dozen Christmas lectures. I think they still do it, actually, but they have done for ages and ages, had this sort of little series of Christmas lectures aimed mainly at children. And that was the Christmas just after The Hobbit was published.
Oh, wow.
So somebody asked, I don't know who actually gave him the invitation, but asked him, and he was an academic at Oxford at the time. And so they asked him if he'd give a lecture on dragons, and he agreed. And then he mentions in the lecture that he got ill and so wasn't able to pull together as many slides as he'd hoped to of the actual dragons themselves. But he had a lot of dinosaur slides.
Oh, cool. That's almost better for our audience than.
Yeah, exactly. So the technology that he was using was a magic lantern. I don't know if you know a magic lantern.
I don't.
So a magic lantern is basically, if you wind back to kind of 20, 30 years ago, we'd have had slide projectors before we were using PowerPoint. And then basically the magic lantern is the earlier version of the slide projector.
Mm.
So the slides are little glass, pieces of glass about, I don't know, 4 inches square, something like that. It's called this late 18th century technology, I think, early 19th, something like that. The magic lantern is basically a box. And it would originally have had a flame in it, a candle or a... They might have used limelight. I don't know if they've used limelight, but some kind of flame. And then they'd project through a lens and through the slide. So it was basically projecting on a wall.
Mm.
And we got one of those from, very kindly, a guy who's the curator of photography at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Just happens to have a collection of these things and was willing to lend us one of them and showed us how to use it. Where I'm getting to is why we did the lecture in the first place. Because basically what we found, or what the museum found, maybe 6 or 7 years ago now, was they were cataloguing their magic lantern slides. And they've got literally thousands of these things from the late 19th century, the early 20th century. And they found 7, which were unmistakably drawn by Tolkien.
Oh, cool.
And actually, there were 4 images across the 7s, because 3 of them were duplicates. And one of them was the very famous image of Smaug that's often on the cover of The Hobbit, you know, the one where he's lying on that pile of gold and Bilbo is standing invisible, so he's blacked out and has a cloud around him. That one. There was one which is less well known, which is from Tolkien's kids' story, Rover Random, which is a dragon flying around the mountain, chasing a couple of flying dogs. There was one which was just one of his doodles, which was a dragon snaked around a tree. And then there was another one which has this lovely caption in the lecture, which is "The Wrong Way to Do It," which is a guy trying to kill a dragon, but he's just sort of standing there on his own with a very spindly spear, and this dragon is curling and rearing over him. So we thought, we've got these slides. Then we thought, well, where's the lecture? Turns out the lecture is in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, because they've got a fantastic Tolkien archive. And they've got the manuscript of it. And then it turned out it was printed once. It's only ever been printed once in a deluxe edition of The Hobbit. I can't remember, maybe about 8 or 10 years ago. It was some sort of anniversary, but I can't remember what it was. But it's hugely expensive. It's sort of 50 quid edition of the Hobbit, £50 edition. So nobody's really got access to this thing. But the Bodleian has a designated Tolkien curator, Tolkien archivist, because they've got so much stuff in the Tolkien estate, and the Tolkien estate is so well off. That they paid for their own bespoke archivist. She got the job for about 6 months, something like 18 years ago, and it's just rolled on. She's never left.
Because there's so much stuff to do.
Amazing, yeah. It's cataloging it and doing exhibitions and such like that. So she did a photocopy for me of this printed one, and I read it alongside the manuscript in Tolkien's own handwriting, which is presumably what he gave the lecture from, in the Bodleian Library. And there were a couple of bits in the printed one which were just slightly wrong, and there were a couple of variants, and so I did kind of a little bit of textual work on it. But the other lovely thing about the handwritten one is he's got little notes to show what slides he was using.
Oh, perfect.
And about the first, I can check, about the first 10 or something like that, 9 or 10, are dinosaurs. Dinosaurs and other prehistoric reptiles. Yeah, 10. And then he's got a few modern ones. He's got frilled lizards and the crocodiles and stuff. And then he's got his own ones. And then there are just a few which we couldn't track down of dragons from other sources. But anyway, we went back to the museum, and they've got a fantastic archivist. And she went through their dinosaur slides and basically, so magic lantern slides, and basically pulled up for us about 150 of these old early 20th century, late 19th century dinosaur slides to look through and see if we could identify the ones that Tolkien used. And for the most part, we could.
Oh, nice.
So we were able to actually recreate it with a magic lantern, with decent selection of the original slides and at least plausible substitutes when they weren't, and with his own slides.
That's fantastic.
So it was great. It was a hoot.
How did you identify the dinosaur magic lantern slides? Was it just like they didn't have a whole ton of that specific dinosaur? So it was like, oh, he's talking about Megalosaurus and this is the Megalosaurus magic lantern slide. So it's got to be that one.
To some extent. So he opens with this slide, which is extraordinary, which is a picture of it's a picture with a dinosaur, a sauropod. It's a Cetiosaurus. Outside the front of the museum with a guy in a bowler hat standing next to it. And he mentions it. He says at the beginning, so I'll just read you a tiny bit of the speech. He says, "Here's an alarming monster outside this building, but he's been removed, so you need not be afraid to go away as soon as you feel inclined." So that's the, and we thought, okay, well, that's got to be that. Actually, that wasn't in the selection they originally gave us. And then somebody at the museum said, I know that image. And they were able to dig it up. And they thought that actually it was real. But I'm sure it's kind of early equivalent to Photoshop. I mean, they basically cut out an image of the Cetiosaurus and pasted it in front and put this guy with a bowler hat. It's neat and funny. And the Cetiosaurus is an Oxford dinosaur, Oxfordshire dinosaur. So, and they've got, I don't know if it's the type specimen or an early fossil of it at the museum.
Yeah, I think it's the holotype. I think you're right.
I think it probably would be because they've got a few, haven't they? They've got the Megalosaurus, the original Megalosaurus description one there. So that one we were able to identify. There's a bunch of them that are quite similar in style. So there's a Stegosaur, a Triceratops that are clearly from the same series. Mm. So I'm pretty sure they were right. There were other ones where we just sort of looked around and thought, okay, we know this is labeled Rhamphorhynchus phillums, which is a pterodactyl, and it's labeled exactly that on the slides. I think he probably goes for ones that he thinks are kind of entertaining, but also match the idea of dragons. So he goes for the Stegosaurus. He says, "What do you think of this stegosaur or plated lizard? No dragon ever had a hornier hide or more fantastic black plates. I believe he was only 20 to 25 feet long and 12 feet high. We're told that a variety of this dragonesque creature once prowled about in these regions." So it's the local associations. It's ways in which he can connect them to dragons. He does the same with the Triceratops. "Here is the giant horned dinosaur, Triceratops, a good name for a horrible creature. They say he might be 10 feet high, over 20 feet long." So he's just getting his audience warmed up with these images.
Yeah.
And I think he's just picked the ones he liked. There were some we couldn't track down. So there's one, I think he talks about Keratosaurus at one point. And the reason he talks about that one, even though we didn't have the slide, we kept this in, is because he says, "One of the prehistoric monsters, less in size than some of them, but exceedingly fierce, was the horned one, Keratosaurus. I mention him first because I believe he was about 20 feet long, passable as a common or heath-haunting dragon. and most because I once read a description of him by a scientific man who strayed off his beat into legend and said that the Keratosaurus would have taxed the skill of St. George to defeat it. Possibly. It was the function of dragons to tax the skill of heroes, and still more to tax other things, especially courage. The Keratosaurus might have taxed St. George's skill. He certainly would not have overtaxed it. Much worse dragons than that were defeated. So you can see he's doing this thing, linking the dinosaurs to the dragons in whatever way he can, really.
That is delightful.
It's such a lovely speech. It's really, really fun. And actually, it's very funny. One of the things that I wasn't sure as I was rehearsing it was how well the jokes would land. But actually, a lot of them are still very funny and at least warm. And, I mean, they're not uproarious, but they're warmly amusing. Mm-hmm. And the audience were quite kind of engaged and laughing along, which helped to then kind of get the performance going too.
Yeah, because even if you're not familiar with who the specific knight is, if you know they defeated a dragon, the concept of them fighting a dinosaur, it's easy to understand.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That is so great. I wasn't sure how much dinosaur stuff there was going to be in there. It's so cool that he tied in the actual Oxford dinosaurs right into the lecture.
Yeah.
Was this one intended for kids too?
I think it was for kids. But, well, kids and families. Mm. So, I mean, basically what he does in the lecture is he starts off really with dinosaurs because he's saying, he raises the questions, were there ever such things as dragons? And then he goes off to talk about, well, look at all these gigantic, terrifying reptilian creatures with scales and horns, and some of them have wings, the pterodactyls. And so he's basically saying, well, there isn't actually a link between them because nobody could have lived with them. He's got kind of an interesting idea of the time frame. Mm-hmm. So when he's writing, he thinks that the Jurassic is sort of 10 to 11 million years ago. Mm. But even for him, that starts to sound quite recent to us now in a kind of modern paleontology. But for him, that's still an unimaginably vast amount of time, as it really, frankly, is. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter whether the number's 10 or 100. Once you're into millions, it doesn't make much odds. It's still so vast. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't say the dinosaurs were the origin of our dragons, but he does say that there's a kind of connection between them in the imagination. And that they sort of make each other plausible. There's a lovely passage where he says, let me see, it's sort of his conclusion about what he's saying about the dinosaurs. He says, dragons once existed then, or horrible creatures did. And though the giant dinosaurs are not supposed anywhere to have been seen alive by any man, other strange and terrible looking creatures existed later and still exist, often of related kinds, serpents and lizards. And just before he says that, he says, it is all the more remarkable that legendary traditions reported monsters so recognizably similar in bodily shape to those reported by modern science, building on quite different evidence. They seem to confirm one another, as it were. The dragon shape has the terrible possibleness of the well-imagined. The reconstructed prehistoric monster has the fantastic legendary quality of the real, when not dulled by familiarity. I think that's lovely.
Yeah,
that idea great. that you just get sort of, you get too used to the real world. And then suddenly you find these unfamiliar things in the real world, these extraordinary creatures. And I guess when he's writing, I mean, there's been the big dinosaur boom in America, hasn't there, in the late 19th, early 20th century. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of these fossils have come from there. But I suppose it's still culturally, dinosaurs have been around for what?
Like 1890s, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's when he's growing up. Mm-hmm. So, and he talks in the lecture actually about finding a fossil himself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because there are all those beaches on the south coast of England where a lot of particularly sort of ichthyosaur and plesiosaur fossils turn up, aren't there?
In Mary Anning's stomping ground.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. I once, as a boy, found a saurian jaw myself with nasty teeth at Lyme Regis and thought I had stumbled on a bit of petrified dragon. So his childhood, I guess, if he's a boy, so this is probably around the turn of the century, just about the same time as those big dinosaur fossils are being found and the bone wars are going on. So it's obviously captured his imagination. And he says in another lecture that actually he was as interested by paleontology as he was by fairy stories when he was a child.
Oh, wow.
So he's kind of captivated by that. But he holds them. He's very aware of the difference between them. Even though he connects them in this lecture, he's very aware of dinosaurs are not dragons, dragons are not dinosaurs, but somehow they have equivalent places in the imagination.
Mm.
One of them is scientific, one of them is legendary, but kind of science bleeds into legend because there's all that reconstruction. And of course, the scientists themselves know something of the legends because dragons are in our culture.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then when he's recreating dragons in his stories, he's aware of the dinosaurs and of the pterodactyls that kind of fit there in the science. So there's a lovely interplay between them, I think.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, we know there was even a recent dinosaur that was named after like a George R. R. Martin dragon.
Oh, was there?
Meraxes gigas, I think is its name. There's a Meraxes. It's not really in the main books, but it's one of those almost like the Cimmerillion equivalent, you know, it's known that it was in these earlier stories kind of thing. And yeah, because paleontologists love dragons because they're, as kids, that's what you learn about and it gets your heart pumping and your brain going.
Yeah, of course, absolutely.
That's so cool. I was going to ask you when Tolkien became interested in paleontology, and it sounds like as early as he, you know, knew how to speak practically.
Yeah. As a kid.
That's so cool. You mentioned, I have to ask because I keep thinking I'm going to ask you this and I keep forgetting to. I know I had read elsewhere that the pterosaurs were sort of his inspiration a little bit for some of the flying creatures, like maybe I think they called them the fell beasts that the Nazgul.
Yeah,
that they rode. But you said there was also some dinosaur influences. Do you know any sort of details about how paleontology directly might have impacted his thoughts about these creatures?
Yeah. It's very hard to pinpoint, I think.
Mm.
So, I mean, I'd heard that too about the Nazgul, and certainly that's, I think, how a lot of us reading those stories and knowing about pterodactyls imagine them riding these kind of Quetzalcoatlus-like creatures.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you look at some of the early textual suggestions, the textual material for those, actually, there's a hint that they're birds, which isn't how they seem in The Lord of the Rings itself. So in the manuscripts, there's some of those kind of... And then I know that he's also... The other thing I'm sure is in his head at that point is aeroplanes, actually, because he hates aeroplanes. And particularly, I think it's to do with, well, it's to do with the Second World War, and it's to do with Guernica and the bombing of Spain, or the bombing of the Republicans in Spain by the Nazis and Mussolini. And actually, the lecture on dragons, it comes round to a kind of notion that dragons are really symbolic of evil, and that there may not be actual dragons out there, but there is evil out there. And I think he's thinking about that. So when the Nazgul fly over and they're those kind of shrieks that they hear at such a distance, I think there's something. I mean, it's obviously before the sonic boom, but it's still something of that.
Yeah, like the engine of a plane.
Exactly. So many things coming together. And then, I mean, with the dragons... Some of his dragons, so Glaurung, I don't know if you're also called Glorund, I think, in different texts, but the one who...
The original.
The first age. Yeah. The original and still the biggest, and is in kind of plagues Hurin and people and is killed by Hurin eventually. That's really based mainly on the dragon from the Sigurd the Volsung legends, the German myths. And actually what he does in the lecture... After the dinosaurs, is he goes on to retell a couple of the sort of big European dragon stories. So he retells the Beowulf story. Beowulf, at the end of that poem, kills a dragon. And he retells the Sigurd story. And Sigurd kills this dragon. And then this curse kind of follows. So I think really that's what he's drawing on. But he certainly... I mean, in terms of his visual imagination, what he's thinking of, I mean, if he talks about Stegosaurus plates as like dragon hide, and he talks about Triceratops horns, you can kind of see that something's going on in his mind, that even if he can't exactly identify where it comes through in the page, gives us a bit of a license to think about these things as a bit more dinosaur-like, as well as dragon-like.
Yeah.
In our own imagination as readers, can kind of freeze you up to do that.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because as somebody who thinks about dinosaurs all day, of course, when I'm thinking about where someone comes up with a dragon, I think dinosaurs. But with Tolkien, it should be obvious to me. No, of course, he's a linguistics guy. He's a scholar of literature. He's looking at other literature. That's where he's coming up with a lot of it.
Yeah. And I think in a way, dinosaurs are almost a modern fashion for Tolkien, with his kind of sense of legendary depth. But one of the things that I really find interesting then about how that affects his writing is that, you know, he in Middle Earth, he kind of imagines this sort of depth of time behind some of the stories. And he's sort of kind of thinking, we know that the Third Age is sometime in our own supposed past. So the Lord of the Rings is happening sometime in our own past. And everything happens kind of pushing back through time. But if you kind of tot up how long that is, it comes to sort of, I don't know, 30,000 years or something. He's thinking in the time frames of history and kind of biblical history, maybe sort of Stone Age kind of distance. He really isn't wanting to use those kind of millions of years that the scientists are offering. And he says this at one point, again, in the lecture, he says that it's a kind of length of time that nobody coming up with a legend would kind of think about trying to use, because it would just be far too beyond reach of people's imagination. Yeah, certainly the wildest of the old legend makers and the most believing of his audience would have felt it an inexcusable exaggeration to deal in such figures. So he himself is writing legend, very aware that somebody else, his colleagues at Oxford University, his colleagues at the museum, are writing science, and they're using totally different sort of sets of scale for thinking about it.
Yeah, that's good. I really wanted to ask you about that, because I've seen that. I think the first place I saw it was on the Wikipedia page about the different ages, and there's the estimates where, you know, the first age was something like 50,000 years ago, because there is this assumption that it's sort of the previous ages of Earth, and there were differences in the continents too. So I was thinking, yeah, was he, because for a long time people did think, you know, the history of the Earth wasn't all that long. Was that what he was thinking? But it seems more like he's working from these literature sources where people were thinking that kind of thing. And so he sort of inherited that from those stories.
Yeah, I think so. He's not a young earther. He doesn't really believe in that. And you can tell that from the lecture. He's quite happy with them. I mean, he likes to maintain a little bit of a sort of wry, skeptical distance, I think. But he doesn't really call it into question. What he does, so one of the things that's really interesting about it is that at an early stage of the composition of some of the Middle Earth stuff, he's writing a book called The Lost Road. And it's a sort of time travel story. But it's a time travel that happens kind of through imagination and sort of recapturing earlier lives and things, rather than kind of a machine. You get into a machine and you travel through time. So no TARDISes or anything like that. But he, in that story, he only writes about the first two or three chapters. And I think it's a real shame, because they're really good. And his hero is kind of having these dreams where he's hearing these languages and gradually sort of interpreting them. And you sort of think, is he talking about himself here? And then he only writes the first couple of chapters, and then there's this sort of sketch plan for what it would have been. And he goes back to Numenor, which is his second age place, sort of Atlantis myth. Then he goes back to the Ice Age. And so he starts to talk about mentions these kings who are found in the ice in the Ice Age. And then he goes back before the Ice Age. So he's clearly actually at that stage, this is in the 1930s, just before he gives this lecture, actually, he's clearly thinking about Middle Earth as fitting into the prehistory that we understand through science. So there's a kind of, there's an overlap going on there, but kind of to, I guess, Stone Age humanity or something. Mm. But obviously where we would find and imagine Stone Age humanity, he finds and imagines all these extraordinary civilizations and these different people like elves and hobbits and such like later.
That's so cool. Is there anything else with the lecture that you really enjoyed being a part of or sharing about Tolkien?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was great fun to perform. So I spent quite a bit of time dredging through whatever recordings I could find of Tolkien's voice. And the challenge was that the lecture was from 1938. And there are two recordings of Tolkien audio recordings from about 1929, 1930, but they're from records that he made as part of a series teaching non-English speakers English. So they're very precise and very clipped and very much received pronunciation. And one of them is about, the one I can remember is about going to the tobacconist's shop. And so that didn't really give me much to go on in the way of a kind of individual voice.
Yeah.
And then all the later stuff is from the 1950s and 60s, when The Lord of the Rings been published and he becomes a celebrity and there are lots of interviews with him. And the voice I was using when I was reading some of the passages out to you was basically derived from that. Mm. But some of that might be because he's an oldish guy by that point. So it was a little bit difficult. So there was the voice. Then there was the costume. So I figured I would have to do it in costume as best I could, which meant me, I live in Oxford. I work at Birmingham, but I live in Oxford. So I was cruising the secondhand clothes shops of Oxford looking for suitable tweed suits and things like that. And I couldn't find them. One thing I did find was a lovely kind of green waistcoat that matched one that he had. There's a photo of him from the early 60s wearing a waistcoat like that. So I thought, okay, I'll get the waistcoat. And then I had to get the kind of Brill cream for my hair to do that. And then the other thing, so we had the magic lantern slides, and I set up a bit of a patter with the archivist who was doing the projection. So that was quite fun. But there's one moment where he talks about the correct way to kill a dragon. And he suggests that the best way to do it is to go underneath it and thrust upward with a short sword. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to have a sword at this moment? And as it happened, about 7 or 8 years ago, I played Satan in a staged reading of John Milton's poem Paradise Lost at New College Chapel in Oxford. And over 3 nights, which was just amazing. It was great. And the chaplain at New College is an old friend of mine. And she had a friend at New College who has a sword. So it's like an 18th century fencing sword, much more sort of not like a modern fencing foil, but a much kind of sort of an inch deep blade and I don't know, quite reasonably long, three foot sword, something like that. So I asked her if we could borrow the sword. So she came along and she had to bring it herself because it was I couldn't be wandering around the streets of Oxford with an unguarded sword. And then I kind of tucked it behind the podium where I was giving the lecture. And just at the right moment, I kind of stooped. He says you have to stoop and strike upwards. So I was able to do the stooping movement and then pull out this sword. I think you've seen the photo, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I was giving the lecture, so I was absorbed by that. But apparently colleagues in the audience were saying there was this sort of kind of inrush of breath. So that was great fun. That was a hoot too.
That's fantastic. Really, also, is there anything else that you'd like to share about your work or anything upcoming you've got going on or anything?
I'm doing more thinking about this kind of Tolkien and paleoanthropology stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm really focused. My colleague, Will Tattersdale, who co-organized the event around dragons and dinosaurs with me, he's really the dinosaur guy. He's doing cultural history work on dinosaurs. That's going to be really interesting. I mean, it's already really interesting, but he's writing a book that we're going to be, I co-edit a series called Explorations in Science and Literature.
Oh, cool.
For Bloomsbury. And he's doing a book for us on dinosaurs.
So awesome.
Not sure quite when it'll be out, but that'll be one to watch when it comes.
Sounds good. Yeah. Let us know and we'll share it.
Yeah. Definitely.
Is there anywhere online where you share your work that you'd like people to know about, like on Twitter, or if there's a research place?
Actually, one thing that people might be interested in is I co-organize a network called Symbiosis.
Hmm.
And what we are is a group of mainly museums, but also academics, who are interested in cultivating the role of the arts in natural history museums. So I work a lot with the Oxford Museum, but also the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, the Naturhistorisches Museum in Vienna, the ones in Berlin, Paris, Porto, Rio de Janeiro, various of these places. That might be of interest to some of your audience.
Cool.
And in fact, there are some talks online. I'll send you the links after this chat, from an online conference we held during COVID at the Oxford Museum. But some of that's about paleo art. A lot of it's about natural history museums. I do stuff on natural history museum architecture, which is one of my kind of passions.
Nice.
Because they're such amazing buildings.
Yeah, well, especially in England.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This was a fantastic interview. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's been great fun chatting to you.
Thank you so much, John, for coming on our show. I'm sorry I missed it, but I'm so glad it was recorded.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of those moments where I saw that this was happening. I think one of our listeners pointed out that this presentation was happening at Oxford. And I was like, oh no, I really wish I could go to that. It sounds so fascinating. And then I thought, wait a second, maybe I can convince them to come on our show. And then it won't be like I missed it. And it was glorious. Especially the parts that he reread. I loved that so much. And in just a moment, we'll get on to our dinosaur of the day, Atlasaurus. But first, we're going to pause for one last sponsor break. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, How Languages Learned. We're very fortunate that we've been able to go on many trips together and see tons of dinosaur museums and sites all over the world. Over the years, we've been drawn to dinosaur museums that are pretty far off the beaten path and not typically where a lot of tourists end up.
Unless you're a dinosaur enthusiast. One of our favorites is the Kita Kyushu Museum of Natural History and Human History in Japan. They have a time traveling room, which reenacts the end of the world for the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous, complete with a gorgeous but haunting, extremely long-necked animatronic Mementosaurus. Knowing just a little bit of kanji made it so much easier for us to get to the museum and to even make it to that amazing time traveling room. It's kind of tucked away. Next time we go to Japan, we'll want to learn and practice our Japanese even more.
Yeah, and Rosetta Stone is a great way to brush up on languages before traveling. Their lessons are immersive, and it's designed to teach you to pick up new languages in a natural way. The lessons are short, about 10 minutes, so you can get them done at any time, even right after listening to a podcast, for example.
Wink, wink.
The best part is you can join now at rosettastone.com/dino, and you'll get a lifetime membership with access to 25 language courses at over 50% off. It's worth $399, but you can get it for just $179, and that's a reduction from last week. They just dropped it for our listeners even more. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now onto our dinosaur of the day, Atlasaurus, which was a request from Cha Raptor and Paleo Mike 716 via our Patreon and Discord. So thanks. It was a sauropod that lived in the Middle Jurassic in what is now Morocco in the Guetioa Formation. It looked somewhat like Brachiosaurus with an upright neck, and it's closely related to Brachiosaurus. There's a lot of similarities in the vertebral column and the limbs, but it is different in that it had a proportionately larger skull, a shorter neck, a longer tail, and longer limbs. And it's also about 15 million years older than Brachiosaurus.
That's quite a bit older.
Yep. The authors that named Atlasaurus described it as a moderately large adult sauropod with unusually long forelimbs and moderately long hind limbs. So, the skull is large, the neck is short, the tail is long, and the limbs are very long.
Does sound pretty Brachiosaurus-like, especially with those longer forelimbs given that upright sort of posture.
Yeah, the short neck is interesting. They found at least 13 neck vertebrae. And the neck's about 12.7 feet or 3.8 meters long.
That is short. I think the iguanodont you had last week or the week before, you said the neck was like 5.5 long, which is only half the size of this neck. Seems crazy.
Yeah, dinosaurs are weird. Atlasaurus is estimated to be about 49 feet or 15 meters long and weighed 22.5 metric tons.
Ooh, it's bulky.
Mm-hmm. And had spoon-shaped teeth. The type species is Atlasaurus imelii. The fossils were found in 1981, a nearly complete skeleton with a skull, and it was described in 1999 by Monbarron, Russell, and Tiquette. The genus name means Atlas lizard, and it refers to the Atlas Mountains where the fossils were found, as well as its size, and the Atlas Mountains were named after the Titan Atlas, who held up the sky. The species name means giant in Arabic.
Okay, that's... I was expecting that the Atlasaurus, when you were talking about the skull, meant that the atlas, which is kind of like the last vertebrae before the head, was going to be different, but I guess it's just because it's really big.
Yeah, and where it was found. Now, according to the 1999 paper, quote, the relative completeness of the skeleton suggests that the animal was borne away and drowned in a flood, then caught on an oxbow or meander and rapidly covered by fluvial sediments mixed with vegetation, end quote. And that partially protected it, though there were some theropod teeth found nearby that were associated with the skeleton, which is kind of interesting.
I feel like the theropod teeth thing, there's just theropod teeth everywhere, because there were some theropods that lost teeth like every single month.
That's true.
So in the fossil record, that, you know, you never know, was that theropod there chewing on it, or was it just there a few days earlier or later dropping teeth like no tomorrow?
There was a second specimen of Atlasaurus found with a nearly complete tail, also from Morocco, found in the 1980s, took 300 hours to clean and prepare. And this specimen ended up in Mexico and was on display in the lobby of BBVA Bancomer Tower in Mexico City. And then in 2018, it got auctioned off to an anonymous businessman to help pay to rebuild some of the 5,000 schools that were damaged in the 2017 Puebla earthquakes, which killed 480 people and caused billions of dollars in damage.
Usually I'm not a big fan of selling scientifically important fossils, but if you can help rebuild 5,000 schools, it's pretty hard to argue with that justification.
Just wait till you hear the whole story. So this tail was about 13 feet or 4 meters long, and it weighed 396 pounds or 180 kilograms, and it was about 70% complete. So it's a good specimen.
Yeah, and they managed to prepare that in 300 hours. That's actually pretty quick. When you hear 300 hours, it sounds like a long time, but when you know it took 4,000 hours to prepare some stuff that's like 10 feet long,
yeah,
it's not bad.
I think it might have taken more than 300 hours because it was somewhere it said 300 hours to clean, and then it was sent to Utah to be assembled.
Okay.
So it might have been a little longer.
Morocco usually has not that difficult of sediment from preparing from what I've seen.
Mm. Well, the tail, it was to be auctioned at a reserve price of about $95,800, and if it sold for more, anything over that reserve price was to go to the schools that were damaged.
Okay.
It ended up selling for, I think, from what I found, $96,000 to $97,000, though some places said that the final sale price was unknown. So it's kind of mixed there in terms of how much it sold for.
So not a lot for the schools.
No, although at least one article suggested about $21,500 ended up being donated.
It doesn't seem like that would repair 5,000 schools.
No, it helps a little, I guess. But after the auction, authorities in Morocco opened up an inquiry about how that tail ended up in Mexico, whether it was illegally exported or not. And the head of Morocco's Cultural Heritage Department said that they would repatriate the fossil. So first, they contacted the auction house to confirm that the seller was legally allowed to sell this fossil. And they said if that was the case, they would buy the fossil back from the new owner and bring it back to Morocco. Hmm. But if that wasn't the case, the Moroccan embassy in Mexico City would use a specific procedure to cancel the sale and repatriate the fossil. And they'd had success in the past because in 2017, they'd successfully removed a plesiosaur that came from Morocco from an auction in Paris. Now, it turns out the tail was sold to an unspecified agency. The auction house Morton said that the tail was acquired from the Petra Gallery, and they said that the fossil was legally purchased in the U.S. And now, unfortunately, I couldn't find an update on what ultimately happened. Maybe there's some stuff still going on because this started in 2018. But it's interesting because it's illegal to sell fossils in Mexico that were found in Mexico, but you can sell fossils found in other countries in Mexico.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, on the surface, it sounds like, yeah, that's good. We're going to help rebuild schools. But there's a little more backstory there.
Yeah, and they didn't get much money, and it may have been an illegal sale.
Yeah, it's a little unclear there, at least from what I could find. Atlasaurus was featured in the 2002 documentary that was published by Discovery Channel called Tracking Africa's Dinosaurs.
It sounds like a good one. I don't remember hearing about that one before, but a Brachiosaurus-like sauropod that had a relatively short neck and is 15 million years older than Brachiosaurus, and we have a skull of and a good tail, so we know a lot about what it looks like. It's a pretty cool dinosaur.
Yeah.
And our fun fact of the day, this is going to be a bold claim.
Okay.
But stick with me. It's that there aren't any living fossil species that have survived since the Mesozoic.
That is a bold claim.
I think there are probably zero species, period, between plants and animals that have survived since the Mesozoic.
But are there genera?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely genera. And basically what I mean is that every species that we have currently that anyone has discovered on Earth is distinct from its ancestor in the Mesozoic, different species. There are good breakdowns by Patrick Pester on Live Science, as well as Worth and Shear in American Scientist. So some of the claimed living fossil animals are sharks. I hear a lot of people talk about, you know, the great white shark. It's such a perfect form that it's basically not changed for hundreds of millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
There's also this Australian ghost shark, I think it's called, which might be the best argument for one because it's still more cartilaginous and it has the shortest DNA chain of a lot of animals. And that's the kind of thing that builds up over time. Basically, the longer an animal is around, you just pile up more and more of these genetic mutations just because DNA tends to mutate over time randomly. So the fact that this one has a really short genetic code, relatively speaking, might mean that it hasn't changed that much. So it might be similar to an earlier species.
Interesting.
Or even be a species from a while ago. There's also coelacanths. I think those are so cool because for the longest time, the story was that there were these fish and eventually some of the fish, the lobe-finned fish, had basically what were the precursors to limbs for land-living animals. And then you had stuff like Tiktaalik where their lobe fins slowly turned into limbs and then those fish went extinct and we only have the ray-finned fish, which are all the fish you see that don't have anything at all like actual limbs. And we thought coelacanths went extinct with that, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But then they just found one by Madagascar one day.
Yep.
They were like, what? What is this? And that's sort of part of the meaning behind the name living fossil. It's something you thought only existed as a fossil. And then you see one out in the wild and you're like, wait a second. This thing should have been extinct. It's so ancient looking.
Well,
it's like a living fossil.
Well, it's interesting that a lot of these are, they live in the water. Which is, you know, it's harder for us to know what's in the water.
That's true. And it's harder for us to find everything at all the levels. Like I've heard people talk about how we know more about things in space than we know about the deepest levels of the ocean, just because it's so hard to get down there and explore it all. But also, I think part of it is that there are some really rigid constraints on aquatic life, like streamlining of the bodies. And so they have these specific sort of forms, and a lot of them will evolve in different ways and sort of converge evolutionarily onto a specific form. So there might be these sort of limits on what the body shape might be like. So if you have a coelacanth, for instance, and it has these lobe fins and a certain body proportion, it's not like its fins are going to dramatically change shape or it's going to grow some big thing on its head or something, because that would totally screw up everything it's trying to do in the water. But anyway, there's also horseshoe crabs, people call living fossils. Terrifying animals, I think. They haven't changed that much. There's velvet worms, which are these interesting little worms, centipede type things that also haven't changed that much. There's the nautilus, which looks a lot like an ammonite. There are tuatara. They're these little reptiles, and they look a lot like things you'd see in the Triassic or the Permian or something. They're sort of sprawled out. They've got little spikes, and they have a head that's a little bit more like an early dinosaur in some ways, with a premaxilla and all that stuff. But it turns out they just evolved from an existing group of animals like 15 million years ago. They just happened to look like that. And then the story with Horseshoe crabs is the same as tadpole shrimp, which is basically, even on the outside, they look quite a bit similar to these fossil forms we have. The closer you look at them and when you inspect their DNA, you find that they're still evolving and that there are changes. So every one of those examples has been shown to be different and a different species than their closest Mesozoic relative. Now, like you said, they could be the same genera. They might still fill a similar ecological niche and look pretty similar. But none of those animals themselves are the exact same thing that was alive in the Mesozoic. Now, I brought up tadpole shrimp because, first of all, they're really interesting animals. They might freak me out even more than horseshoe crabs.
Why?
They kind of look like the cross between a horseshoe crab and an earwig.
Okay.
Do you know what an earwig is?
Yes.
Those like pincher tail, creepy little bugs.
Yeah.
But apparently they're helpful for eating mosquito larvae, so they're not all bad.
That's good.
Also, in 2010, Guinness gave them the world record of the, quote, oldest living creature. And specifically, they said that Triops cancriformis, I think, which is a tadpole shrimp in the UK, was the oldest living creature. So they named a specific species.
And how far back does that go?
They were saying that it goes all the way back to the Triassic.
That's interesting. When we talk about dinosaurs, we always say, like, no more than 2 million years.
Yeah, exactly. And studies of their DNA showed that despite physical similarities, their ancestors are a different species. One estimated that the age of the oldest current tadpole shrimp was a maximum of 25 million years old, the oldest species, which is only about 10% of the way back to the Triassic. And a more recent study estimated that they might only be about 2.6 million years old, or only about 1% of the way back to the Triassic. And there have been several studies that basically found that looking at DNA evolution rates and mutation rates, it seems like almost all species only last between 600,000 and 3 million years, and 2 million is a very common average that's given. So what about plants?
Oh yeah, those last a long time.
Because there are also a lot of plants that get claimed as living fossils. So some contenders are horsetails. We've talked about dinosaurs eating them. There's ginkgo, very commonly cited as a living fossil, and also cycads.
Yeah, cycads just look like they belong in the Jurassic.
Yeah, and apparently cycads and ginkgo are pretty close relatives, and I think both of the Wikipedia pages even call them living fossils. It's a very popular name. And again, if you look at a fossil of a cycad and a fossil of a ginkgo leaf, they look really similar going back a long time. But again, every current species is also different from the closest Mesozoic relative. With this one, it's a lot closer. I had to say Mesozoic relative. I was originally going to make this fun fact, like there aren't any living fossils older than 3 million years. But one of the ginkgo genus actually might go back like 50 million years. They haven't really nailed it down. Ginkgo biloba, they're like, maybe it's like 55 million years old. So it might almost get back to the Mesozoic, but we're confident that it doesn't make it all the way past that KPG boundary.
Interesting genera.
And I should say too, the definition of a species is pretty blurry. I like to use the most widely accepted definition of a species, which is organisms that can breed and produce fertile offspring. It's sort of been changing recently because with DNA evidence, we'll look for animals that have basically very distinct DNA from each other that shows that they evolved separately. But the difficulty with fossils is typically we only see the shape of the outside of the animal or maybe the skeleton if they have a skeleton, which might stay the same for many successive species. You could have a very similar species for 10 million years and it could be five different species.
So just superficially, it looks the same.
Exactly. Especially from a human bias, because if we're looking at something like a coelacanth, we might not notice these subtle differences in how they're fins wiggle or whatever that you might be able to see in the fossils, but it could be really subtle to our eyes. I could have also phrased the fun fact that every animal is a living fossil. I thought about doing that.
You go from there's no living fossil species to everything is a living fossil.
Yeah, it depends on your perspective. It's either all or nothing, because every animal on Earth has DNA that goes back billions of years. We're all descended from the same common ancestors. Every single animal, every plant, all go back together. And depending on how you frame it, we all also have features from our distant ancestors that could be considered part of a living fossil. One example I came up with is that there are 8 major types of eyes that all go back quite a while. One type of eye is shared by every terrestrial vertebrate, and it's a specific type of chambered eye with a lens and cones for distinguishing color.
Mm-hmm.
They evolved about 350 million years ago, along with 4 types of cones for different parts of the color spectrum.
It's served us well.
It has. And humans, well, most humans, don't have 4 types of cones because evolutionarily, some animals, like humans, have lost some of these cones over the years, so we can't see quite the same spectrum that some of our ancestors could. But the eyes in our heads are very similar to every other mammal that has ever lived, as well as amphibians, some fish, and even every dinosaur. So if you're looking into somebody's eyes or looking in your own eyes in the mirror, you can think about how a dinosaur probably had very similar eyes to that.
Hmm.
Or if you just look at a bird eye, they do look very human-like if you just see the eye up close.
Interesting.
Yeah. So depending on the animal, or maybe if there's some alien species looking at us, they'd be like, oh, they look just like these fossils that we can see on Earth as well.
And that wraps up this episode of I Know Dino. Thank you for listening. If you want easy access to all the links in our show notes, then sign up for our newsletter at inodino.com. And stay tuned. Next week, we'll be talking about dinosaur claws and dinosaur play. Thanks again, and until next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.